You're listening to Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
A Separation is the critically acclaimed film by director Asghar Farhadi and is the first Iranian film to win the Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. To tell us more about this movie, we are joined today by critics Marty and Martha Roth, and they're here in the studio with me now. Welcome back to Red Eye.
Hi, Manuel.
Well, nice
Thank
to
you.
Be back.
So, how does this film start?
Well, it opens with a scene that feels like cinema verite. A husband and wife sit in front of the camera, and we look at them from the judge's point of view. The wife is petitioning for a divorce from her husband, a truculent man who stubbornly refuses to engage with her and discuss their problems. The scene ends on a gap, a lacuna. The wife wants the divorce because her long-awaited travel visa has come through, but her husband, who is tied to a senile, incontinent father, refuses to leave the country with her. The disembodied voice of the judge behind our back speaks out, asking the wife why she wants to leave the country, but shutting her off as she answers that she doesn't want her daughter to grow up in. The last word, Iran, is never uttered. The judge doesn't want to hear what anyone has to say against the country. I took this opening signal very seriously because, for me, what was missing in the film is Iran. On a descriptive level, that's an absurd claim, since Iran is totally present, admirably so, with great specificity. But in another sense, the Iran that we in the West come to this movie to see, the Iran that fills our newspapers with unspecified foreignness and threat, is not really there. Neither is a context or an explanation of the growing dilemma this wife and husband find themselves implicated in.
What did you think of the film?
Well, I loved it. I've seen it several times now. For me, it's a film about separations of many kinds. The strong script, which Farhadi also wrote, it does justice to all of the characters. His young daughter actually plays the daughter in the film, and his eye fills the frame with doors, walls, and windows, everything human beings use to separate ourselves from one another, both for good and for not so good. All of the actors convinced me, adults as well as children. The principal actors, Peyman Moadi, Shahab Hosseini, Sare Bayat, and Leila Hatami, are well known in Iran, which has, as we know, a mature and sophisticated cinema industry, and they all give splendid performances. In the opening scene, I wanted to respond to Marty's remark about Iran not being present. As he says, it is and it is not. The word is never mentioned in the film, but yet we are in Iran. In the opening scene, the wife, Simin, wears a headscarf. Although she and her husband are recognizably secular middle-class people. And the family situation with the dependent parent is one that we all recognize. The differences from a North American reality emerge only gradually. Simin wants to leave the country with their daughter, Termeh, and Nader, the husband, will agree to a divorce, but not to her taking the child. The couple argue in impassioned tones. "You know I can't go," he says. "I know you won't go," she says. "I can't because of my father," he says. "He's old," she says. "He has Alzheimer's. You won't go. It doesn't matter to him. He doesn't even know you." "Why can't you leave him?" "I can't," says the man. "You must," says the woman. "I can't." Finally, the judge says, "Don't waste my time with your little problems. Go back to your life and work things out. It is my judgment that you have little problems." And then back in the apartment, the mother is packing her suitcase with trembling fingers, and she drives to her parents' home, weeping as she drives. And meanwhile, the daughter has to tell her father how to operate the washing machine.
What else changes in Nader's life when his wife leaves?
Well, Nader's father is a man cut off from himself. Cruel dementia has stolen most of his voice and his mind. With Simin gone from the house, Nader must hire a caregiver to spend the day with his father while he's at work and Terma is at school. Rosia, the woman he hires, comes from a very different class and culture. Rosia's husband is an unemployed cobbler, and we soon discover a hothead who dominates his wife and daughter. They are devout. And this final separation, the devout from the secular, provides the hinge on which the plot turns. Rosia has a long commute from her working-class home to the pleasant district where Nader lives, and she must bring her young daughter to work with her. At first, she attempts to have the child help with household tasks, but the little girl creates potential disasters, spilling bagged garbage on the marble stairs of the apartment house and playing with the gauge on the old man's oxygen tank.
How does Rosia cope with her new job?
Well, it's very interesting. She's not sure at first whether she is permitted to care for the old man. After all, she's a woman, he's a man. When he soils his pants, she phones for advice on whether she may clean him up, because it involves seeing his nakedness. Her daughter says, "I won't tell Dad," and Rosia kisses her and calls her "my little angel." The situation deteriorates rapidly. Rosia cannot cope with the old man, who wanders and even leaves the apartment if he's not being watched. Nader comes home early in Razia's employment, and he finds his father tied to the bed, and Rosia is missing. When she comes back, and we in the audience know that she has been to an ultrasound clinic because she is pregnant, when she comes back, he chews her out. Some money is missing. The little girl probably took it, but Nader blames the mother. He loses his temper, shouts at her to leave, and finally pushes her out the door.
And later that evening, Simin calls her husband to tell him that Rosia fell on the stairs, claiming that Nader pushed her, and that has miscarried her pregnancy. The couple go to visit Rosia in the hospital and have their first encounter with the violent husband. Then Nader must face a charge of murder. The judge is definite. If he pushed her, he caused the fall which led to the miscarriage, and he is guilty of the death of a 4.5-month-old fetus, a person. In turn, Nader threatens to sue Rosia for bruising his father. People seem to be encouraged to go to court against one another, trying to use a clumsy legal system to redress the resentments of an unequal society. Simin and Nader wonder if they should lie, and Terma goes through a wrenching, visible process of disenchantment, discovering that her adored parents might be willing to encourage deliberate falsehood to escape imprisonment. Much of the film is devoted to the question of whether or not Nader knew that Rosia was pregnant, and the film does a lot of forward and backtracking over this issue. The morality of all the characters is called into question.
And what about the husband?
Razia's husband. Yes, well, a late scene in the film shows him in a rage, the husband. He shouts at her, she shouts at him. He raises his fist, but instead of hitting her, he hits himself. Don't hit yourself, she screams. But he keeps punching himself in the head, and it looks as though he might do himself an injury. He is a picture of a split person, a violent man who will express his rage at things to cover, at things over which he has no control. He's lost his job. The other couple is much more prosperous. He's humiliated because his wife has to care for a strange man. And when he feels rage at these things, he harms himself.
So it seems like there's a lot of complex relationships and dynamics going on. Does the film suggest a solution to these dynamics?
Not really. No. It ends as it began, on an absence. Still another judge asks Terme to choose which parents she will live with, but the ending leaves us not knowing the future for Nader, Simin, and Terme. Will mother and daughter separate? Husband and wife, daughter and father. We are fairly sure Nader will not leave his father. But we've seen the fabric of family relationships strain and fray under the stresses of living. Living in contemporary Iran, maybe just living in general. But we understand why Simin wants to separate her growing daughter from a society in which a single judge can decide without recourse how people will live. At the still center of this very volatile story, there is the daughter, Terme, who sees and listens and looks extremely somber and says little of what she thinks or feels.
So the film's story rests on this chain of sort of complex events. What would you say is the deeper significance? Is there a deeper significance?
Well, I didn't find it. And while I admired the art of the film greatly, I found myself resisting the story. It was just too tightly determined for my absolute liking. The immobilizing situation of the father is a given in the film, and it's severe enough to make even an ordinary mixture of work and family life extremely difficult, if not impossible. So for me, the film was domestically overburdened to begin with, and it felt as if any further disturbance would send these lives into a tailspin. I watched the film as the unfolding of a domestic tragedy in a deterministic world in which one tear in the social fabric just keeps widening and widening with ever more dire results, and I failed to see any strong social or political connections. The Iranian title of the film, The Separation of Nader from Simin, reinforces a domestic reading, I believe.
Well, I disagree, of course. I see Nader's anger as the universal response of a man to a woman's leaving him. This is the point at which men kill women, and it's relatively recently that we in the enlightened West have begun to understand this violent, possessive male rage. I don't know much about Sharia law, but it's possible that it has a much more nuanced understanding of that dynamic. Nader is highly civilized. We have no fear that he will harm Simin or Terme, but several characters in the film expect violence from the lower-class man, Razia's husband. Because he is working class, probably, and we don't get a sense of whether violence against women is strongly forbidden in that society, although I believe it is. When he is hitting himself instead of his stubborn wife, I thought that Farhadi might be making that point.
Well, I mean, that's certainly a good reading of the film, but I'm not quite there yet. I also half suspect that the film may be a very conservative fable, that for the filmmaker, the spiraling consequences may all be the result of the initial sin of trying to break up a marriage. I don't like to read the film this way, but nothing that I see later on militates against it.
Whereas I see it as a wonderfully complex look at social relations in the 21st century, in a country struggling to adjust its revolutionary values, with a world in which previously disadvantaged groups, like women, are claiming space. I was moved by the film's even-handedness. Anthony Lane in The New Yorker called the film a democratic portrait of a theocratic world, and that felt accurate to me. He wrote the script, remember. I believe he sympathizes with every character and sees what separates each one from all the others.
Well, it seems like you two have very different opinions about this film, so I guess our listeners will have to make up their own mind. I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Manuel.
Yes.
And we would encourage people to see it.
Oh, yes. Yes. And I think it may still be available. If not, it's certainly available on DVD or streaming or whatever other new technological gimmick has come up in the last couple of days.
Yeah. Well, apparently it's still playing at the Empire 7 on Granville Street.
Oh, at the Granville. Yes. Good.
So go check it out and make up your own mind.